The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. I'm back behind the mic. Thanks to our wonderful producer, Sam, for stepping behind the mic on yesterday's program. Did you avoid heresy?
I hope so.
He hopes so. If you want to listen to Sam's broadcast from yesterday, it's posted at thetrumpet.com. website. Lots going on here at the Edstone campus with the beginning of the Philadelphia Youth Camp. Orientation kicked off last night with camp director. This year's director is Brad McDonald, and he revealed the theme for this camp. Action this day, to borrow those famous labels from Winston Churchill's time as the first Lord of the Admiralty back in 1939. He was a man of action. Churchill was more concerned about inaction than he was about action. He, as you know, so many of you, he was sounding the alarm throughout the 1930s, calling for Britain's leadership to act. To act. When Brad McDonald was going through his orientation lecture last night, I was thinking about that brilliant speech that Churchill gave back in 1935. I mean, even then, they could have acted, but he talked about the revelations from the early part of that year when at least the leadership was finally acknowledging that that Germany had rearmed. And Churchill, before the House of Commons, he said in May of 1935 that when the situation was manageable, it was neglected, and now that it is thoroughly out of hand, we apply too late the remedies, which then might have effected a cure. There's nothing new to the story, he said. It's as old as the Sibylline books. It falls into that long, dismal catalog of the fruitlessness of experience and the confirmed unteachability of mankind. Want of foresight, unwillingness to act, when action would be simple and effective. Lack of clear thinking. Confusion of counsel, until the emergency comes, until self-preservation strikes its jarring gong. These are the features which constitute the endless repetition of history. It just happens over and over again. You'll see it in the news segment here that we'll get to in just a moment. But this has been the way of man. There was an unwillingness there to act, and I mean, Britain acted only when Churchill came on the scene, and even then, it was very nearly too late. Too late. Britain entered into its darkest hour in 1940, but not for Churchill, the man of action. There's no way that Britain would have survived, even before he came into office. As you probably know, he set up this this intelligence gathering system, headquartered at Chartwell, his estate in Kent, just south of London. And according to Manchester's biography, the estate had been transformed into a state within a state, with advisors, researchers, filing cabinets, and mounted charts. Approaching the end of his life, Macmillan would remember, "I shall always," this is quoting someone who is familiar with the setup, "I shall always have a picture of that spring day, and the sense of power and energy, the great flow of action which came from Churchill, although he then held no public office." Here's an eyewitness to these events talking about the flow of action coming from Churchill. This was when he was in the wilderness. This was when no one was listening to him. And still, I mean, he stood alone. He stood alone when everyone else, as this Macmillan said, seemed dazed and confused, and they were hesitating. But not Churchill. He was acting. You can see why God used him as a man of action. at a time when Britain desperately needed someone to act. So the theme, as I say, for this year's PYC at Edstone is action this day. And man, Mr. McDonald last night was admonishing our young people to be doers of the Word of God and to start making little changes today, now, to not put it off. Don't wait. Do it now. He quoted Einstein, who said, "Nothing happens until something moves." Get moving. Be a doer of the Word of God, as James 1 and verse 22 says. Well, I thought I'd also pass along some really exciting news regarding the Hezekiah Isaiah exhibit that's been going on for a number of weeks now. And part of this is due to the visits or the visit of all the campers to the exhibit last week. But last week, we saw our largest number of visitors to the exhibit since the grand opening week. All total, we had 628 visitors. So that's a lot more than just the 144 who came for the PYC. The exhibit, by the way, has been extended. I'm not sure we've announced that yet, but that we were praying for this. Remember, it was going up through, late August. And so we've had some communication with the Israel Museum, the Israel Antiquities Authority there in Jerusalem. And we were hoping at least to get it extended through the Feast of Tabernacles so all that visit Edmond could see the exhibit from, you know, from people coming in all over the world, but also as a bonus to have it extended through the ministerial conference in January. And as it happens, we get an extension that takes us through January of 2019. So that's pretty amazing, pretty exciting news. And of course, to see these numbers, the number of visitors, and to see it actually increasing into the heat of the summer. This is the hottest time of the year in Edmond, Oklahoma. And we're getting quite a few visitors. Yesterday, we had 155 visitors. That's putting the total for this year at 2,749. We're talking about thousands of people that have seen this exhibit in what they would probably say in the middle of nowhere, right in the middle of Nowhereville, Oklahoma. And then the response, too, the reaction that we're getting from people online or who send emails after the fact. This one here from Facebook, it says, "Armstrong University is a jewel in a crown. Wish more of our community would take more advantage of its offerings." Another one on Facebook said, "I love the experience of walking in Hezekiah's tunnel." I'm looking forward to that when I get over there in a couple of weeks. Another one writes, "We toured this morning, beautiful facility, and the display was very well done." And this one says, "This was a wonderful, detailed exhibit, from the timeline to the explanation of the seals and the schematic of the Iron Gate, Hezekiah's tunnel. I love the video of the archaeologist who discovered the artifacts. Her enthusiasm was contagious." Speaking of Dr. Mazar, of course. And then she says, "Coincidentally, in Sunday school, we have been studying the book of Isaiah the past 3 weeks, and it was amazing to see our study before our eyes with the actual artifacts from that time. God is so good. Thank you also, Armstrong Foundation, for bringing this to Oklahoma." Here's another one that says, "Didn't know this place even existed. Thank you so much, Armstrong Auditorium, for sharing at no cost. It was very touching and professional. I was so impressed with everything, including the bird fountain." The swans in flight, or the bird fountain, as this person says. Another one here says, "Thanks so much for this exhibit. I went there today with some friends, and it was fascinating. The guide was very knowledgeable and able to answer our many questions. He had been on a dig with the archaeologists who discovered these seals, and they have become friends." And then one last one here. This was an email. It says here, "My church group," it's amazing how many church groups have been impacted by this exhibit. "My church group had a wonderful time at the exhibit of the seals of King Hezekiah and the prophet Isaiah. What a gift you have given to those of us who love the integrity of the scriptures. Our guide Sherry did an excellent job in her tour of the exhibit. She was articulate, knowledgeable, and patient with the loquacious members of our group." We're going to use that word more, loquacious. It's a fantastic word. "Thank you again for making the Bible come alive once again." That comes from a Bible teacher. I guess, a Sunday school teacher. So there's people from some of the congregations coming to see the exhibit. The congregations around Oklahoma that probably wouldn't know much about the Philadelphia Church of God were it not for Armstrong Auditorium and this wonderful exhibit. Well, to get into the news, I just want to focus primarily on a piece, an excellent piece by Victor Davis Hanson. It was in National Review yesterday, titled Russianism. Russia, of course, has been in the news. It's all Russia every day, all the day long. Russia, Russia, Russia. And as Hanson defines Russianism, it's this psychological malady in which furor at Donald Trump's election victory and presidency finds release through fixation on Russia. Since when have progressives been fixated on the danger of an emerging power in Russia? Well, for decades, it's been standard policy for the radical left to coddle dictators in Russia, to appease them, to give them what they want, to praise them. And so what an astounding turnaround here to see now, as we've brought this point out before, but now everyone on the radical left, they're Russian hawks all of a sudden. Hanson says here, the recent orthodox, progressive, and democratic view of Russia until the appearance of Donald Trump was largely what it had been throughout the Cold War, one of empathy for Russia and understanding of its dilemmas and shame over supposed right-wing American paranoia over a bogus Russian bear. Well, as he alludes to there, it was this way up until the appearance of Donald Trump. The Trump derangement syndrome, it's dramatically reversed their long-standing strategy of coddling the dictators. Listen to what, I think this was something the president tweeted out the other day. It's a short statement from then-Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and what she said in 2010 about a strong Russia, clip one.
I mean, we want very much to have a strong Russia because a strong, competent, prosperous, stable Russia is, we think, in the interest of the world.
They made no bones about it. She wanted Barack Obama. They wanted a strong, confident, prosperous Russia. Now she's responded to the president's tweet by saying, "Well, hey, I said that when Medvedev was in power, as if Putin was out of the scene." That's how they justify it. We came in there and look, we had a really good leader. He was nothing like Putin. Well, Medvedev revealed himself. And the sham, really, of the Russian elections when he leaned over to Barack Obama and said that I'll transmit this to Vladimir. Everyone knew. Hillary Clinton knew. Barack Obama knew who was running the show back at that time. But even leaving that aside, I mean, there she was saying that she wanted a strong Russia. What would happen to President Trump if he said something like that? They made no bones about it coming in 2009. They were ready to press the reset button. They came out with an actual button. It didn't say reset. It said something else. But still, I mean, it was a new direction for the United States and for its foreign policy. Here's what Hillary Clinton said in 2009. This is clip two.
We believe that there are a lot of challenges and threats that we have inherited that we have to address, but there are also opportunities. And we are being extremely vigorous in our outreach because we're testing the waters. We're determining what is possible. We're turning new pages and resetting buttons, and we're doing all kinds of efforts to try to create more partners and fewer adversaries.
They were being extremely vigorous in their outreach in order to create fewer adversaries. They were trying to befriend Russia. And that was an interview with NPR, and she was asked by the journalist there, well, what about Europe's warm reception that it's given to the Obama administration? And she went on to say in that same interview, clip three,
And it's important to demonstrate that the United States is back. We are listening. We're consulting.
We're back now because George W. Bush, well, he slapped sanctions. And they were modest sanctions at that. Victor Davis Hanson brings that out in his piece. But now with the Obama administration in 2009, I mean, you have an America that was willing to take on a much kinder, softer, gentler approach when it comes to working with Vladimir Putin. They hit the reset button, as she said in that same interview, clip four here.
Well, we're going to hit the reset button and start fresh because clearly the Obama administration believes that there are a number of important areas to discuss with the Russians. We're just at the beginning of this discussion, but I'm looking forward to it.
They're very optimistic about befriending the Russian bear. And Victor Davis Hanson, in his piece, he says, then we witnessed, you know, after this reset, we witnessed a turning new pages effort by the Obama administration to downplay Russian aggression and emphasize its own new creative outreach to Putin. They thought the Russian strongman would be charmed by humanitarian sanctimoniousness and the hope and change charisma of Barack Obama. Instead, Putin, true to character, saw weakness accompanied by pious sermonizing. That's always a fatal combination when dealing with the brute. And so Putin proceeded to gather up his easy pickings. He sent Russia on the march. And as Hanson brings out in his piece, I mean, there's a lot about Russia, really. There's a lot of weakness there because of their economy and such. I mean, the nukes, those are what give Putin the ability to punch above his weight. But here goes Russia. And you know all about the hot mic gaffe that happened, what was this, in early 2012, March of 2012, where you have President Obama leaning over to Medvedev at the time, promising flexibility, and Medvedev's response saying, I'll pass this along to Vladimir. Here's clip five.
My last election, basically. Yeah. After my election, I have more flexibility.
I understand. I transmit this information to Vladimir and let's stand with him.
It's hard to make it all out, but that's Medvedev leaning over saying, I understand what you're saying about flexibility, and I will transmit this information to Vladimir. It was just a few months after that where everyone remembers in the debates, Obama just absolutely ridiculed Romney for suggesting that Russia might pose some kind of a threat. That was just in 2012. He told Romney, are you living in the 80s? What, are you living in the Cold War? And now, like Victor Davis Hanson says, here come the left-wing progressives creating another Cold War, basically. They want it. They want it to bring down Donald Trump. Hanson says Obama more than fulfilled this promise, the promise of flexibility, in early 2013 after Putin's 2012 hiatus in aggression. He canceled the final phase of missile defense based in Eastern Europe. The Obama administration showed indifference to the absorption of Crimea and Eastern Ukraine. Just gave it a pass. Just let him do what he wants. There is also not much anger over prior Russian cyber attacks on the United States. Those were going on not just from Russia, China too, all through the Obama administration. And yet they didn't sit up and take note until after Hillary Clinton lost. You'll recall what he said before the election in 2016. We played it recently. Here's clip six.
There is no serious person out there who would suggest somehow that You could even rig America's elections.
If you even thought that the election could be rigged because of Russian meddling, you're not even a serious person. And he went on to say that there's no evidence that it's even happened, past or present. Here's clip seven.
There's no evidence that that has happened in the past or that There are instances in which that will happen this time.
Referring to 2016. And so he told Donald Trump, look, stop whining about meddling and just go out and try to get the votes. They thought Hillary was going to win for sure. And so then they, and dramatically so, they changed the tune. As soon as Donald Trump won the election, Hansen says Hillary Clinton was instrumental in persuading the U.S. government to greenlight sales of American uranium to Putin-connected companies. It is surely not a coincidence that Russian interests paid Bill Clinton a $500,000 honorarium for a single speaking gig in Moscow shortly after the Russians announced their intention to acquire a majority stake in Uranium One, and that pro-Putin Russians gave multi-million dollar donations to the Clinton Foundation. Can you believe this? And yet, because of Carter Page going to Moscow for a conference with speakers from all over the world, that's what the FBI used to justify this FISA court application to spy on the Trump campaign. And yet for a period of years, you have Hillary Clinton as the Secretary of State greenlighting all the sales of American uranium. And then Bill Clinton around the same time getting $500,000 for a speech in Moscow. The money coming from Russian interests, Russian sources, and then the millions and millions that were donated to the Clinton Foundation from pro-Putin Russians. No red flags there in any of that for the FBI, for the DOJ, for the Obama administration, for the media. The media didn't see anything wrong with these kinds of acts. He says, too, don't forget about the lobbyist Tony Podesta receiving the generous contributions from Russians. Hansen says Obama refused to arm the Ukrainians, and his green energy anti-fracking policies played right into Russian oil interests. His defense cuts contributed to NATO laxity. Secretary of State John Kerry invited Putin into the Middle East after a 40-year hiatus. It proved a pathetic effort to get the Obama administration off the hook of enforcing the very ultimatum, the now infamous red line, that it had issued to the genocidal Assad government. And it might well have convinced Putin that annexing former Soviet territory would likewise have few consequences. In sum, Hansen writes, according to the protocols of contemporary progressive hysteria and an unhinged media, all of the above, if done by the Trump administration, would have been redefined as impeachment-worthy collusion or far worse. But you see, because it was Obama doing it, there was nothing. No one sounded the alarm. The media applauded him every step of the way. And even when the fruits were proven to be disastrous, even when the facts started coming in that the reset didn't work, they still congratulated themselves. They still looked at their dealings with Russia and with Putin as a great success. Listen to what Hillary Clinton said in a June 2014 BBC interview. This is an interview where even the interviewer seems shocked that she would somehow defend the reset policy that was established there in the first year of the Obama administration. Here's clip 8.
Let me talk a little about Russia. Mm. You famously pressed the reset button. Mm-hmm. Are you embarrassed by that now, that gesture?
No, I thought it was a brilliant stroke, which in retrospect appears even more so, because look at what we accomplished. Between the Russian invasion of Georgia in August 2008, which of course torpedoed relations between the United States and Russia for good reason, we come into office, and for that period of time, the interregnum, if you will, Medvedev is president and Putin is prime minister. And there were jobs we wanted to get done. We wanted to
get Russia on board with tough sanctions against Iran. We wanted to have a New START treaty to limit nuclear weapons. We wanted to get their help in transiting across their huge country to get things we needed into Afghanistan. We got all that done. Putin comes back. Look where we are now. He invaded another country. So, yes, but while we had that moment, we seized it, we used it, and succeeded.
It was a brilliant strategy, she said in 2014. The best part of that clip, by the way, is watching the interviewer's face as she tries to explain the brilliance of the reset button. Even a BBC reporter, when asking Hillary Clinton about the reset from 2009, even a BBC reporter asks, are you embarrassed? No. No, and in fact, it was brilliant. And the more time goes on, we're seeing just how brilliant it really and truly was. Well, all of that changed abruptly in November of 2016. And we know about the spying. We know about the plant. We know about the abuse of power. We know about the FISA court applications based on the phony dossier. And, of course, we know about Strzok and Page and McCabe and Comey and Clapper and Brennan. And we know about the Mueller probe as well. Hansen says, but out of the Mueller conundrum and congressional investigations arose damning information that Obama national security officials illegally unmasked and leaked to the press the names of those surveilled. Well, they were just spreading the information all over the intelligence community. They were hurrying to do it. They wanted to spread it around as Donald Trump was coming into office. But the thing of it is, like my father has pointed out, the more that is revealed about what happened in 2016 and 17, the more we're learning about the lawlessness, not of the Trump administration, but of the Obama administration. Hansen says, in addition, DOJ and FBI officials deliberately misled either gullible or partisan FISA court judges to obtain those surveillance warrants. It says discredited FBI officials lied to federal investigators. The former FBI director leaked confidential memos written on FBI time, on FBI devices. And he probably worked with CIA director John Brennan, who had previously lied twice under oath to the U.S. Congress to monitor the Trump campaign, including but not limited to implanting government informants among Trump employees. He says here, Victor Davis Hanson, in sum, Russian collusion is a 2016 election construct. It's just fake news or fake intelligence brought on by a fake dossier. He says the hysteria over it serves as a palliative for hatred of the presidency that so far cannot be stopped before 2020. And then he talks about what just how different it would be had Hillary Clinton won. And my dad brings this out. My father writes about this in Great Again, or maybe not Great Again, but those two articles from The Trumpet, the one about the Nunes memo in the April Trumpet magazine, and then the one in May about saving America from the radical left. Well, toward the end of his article, as I mentioned, Hansen talks about, you know, Russia. I mean, what Russia without its nukes basically is as much of a threat to the United States as Venezuela would be. But it has the nukes, so it's able to punch above its weight. But he has a fascinating conclusion here about China, Victor Davis Hanson. He says, as for Russia itself, it is as much an enemy or friend of the U.S. as is China, but its espionage campaign against the U.S. pales in scope and resources to the Chinese, to that of the Chinese. And then he talks about Russia's aggressions along its border do not match China's intimidation of neighbors or its creation and militarization of some, all of the islands and things that they're building in the South China Sea. And he brings in North Korea's nuclear proliferation and how that China is largely responsible for that, not Russia. Hansen says all of that is not to say that Putin would not act like China if he could, only that he lacks the wherewithal to do so. With an economy 1/20th the size of ours and with a long-standing crisis of demography, longevity, and social equilibrium. Well, he brings out that here you've seen the emergence of these powers. China, too. This all happened under Obama's watch. Its massive expansion into the South China Sea, building all those military installations. Trumpet Hour last week, Jeremiah Jacques gave a great update on China making the move, or at least the indication is there, that now is the time to act with respect to Taiwan. We've talked about that over the years as well. It's coming. I mean, my father was writing about that, as Jeremiah said, back in the 1990s. China devouring Taiwan. Well, it says in the final conclusion here, it's difficult to imagine what else Trump might still do to punish Putin. He's already beefed up sanctions, expelled Russians, had Russian mercenary thugs killed in Syria, sent threats to Putin not to overreach in Syria, armed the Ukrainians, expanded U.S. oil production, increased defense spending, jawboned NATO to toughen up, and blasted German-Russian appeasement and the dangerous developing German dependency on Russian fossil fuels. You look at the actions, that's what he's saying here. I mean, what do the members of the media want for Donald Trump to do? Start bombing Moscow? But the thing that's real fascinating here, when you look at these two presidents, Barack Obama and then now Donald Trump, in the Obama years, the strategy was to appease. The strategy, as you heard from those first sound bites, it was to make nice. It was to coddle the dictators. It was to turn a blind eye to their acts of aggression. It was to give them a pass. It was to reach out and to talk to them without preconditions, as Obama proudly stated with respect to Iran. And then along comes Donald Trump, the disruptor. And he is disrupting. He comes into Europe just a few weeks ago. And he says, hey, you're not paying your fair share. And hey, we're going to slap some tariffs on you. This is unfair, the trade practices. And he's doing the same thing to China. And like Richard Palmer brought out on Trumpet Hour Friday as well, there was a New York Times piece, I think that was on Friday or Thursday from last week, and then another one in the Los Angeles Times. And again, these are left-wing publications, so they've got something in them to go after Donald Trump for sure. But at the same time, I mean, as the New York Times title says, Europe and Asia are moving to bolster global systems that Trump has attacked. And they are, like Richard said on Friday, Europe's reaching out to China with trade agreements. Europe's reaching out to Japan. Europe's slapping fines on Google. So much of the weakness, though, of America's position, and really the weakness of NATO as well. This is brought out in Victor Davis Hanson's piece. It was brought on by the 8 years of inaction. Inaction when it comes to confronting real existential threats. Now, the one area where you certainly do see action on the part of the Obama administration is when it comes to going after political enemies. Then it's every kind of illegal action, if need be. The ends justify the means. But look at what we're seeing here. I mean, the world is being turned upside down. And the United States, as we'll cover in the next segment, it has a wound, as it says in Micah, that is incurable. It's not going to be fixed by any kind of president. We'll look at that more when we come back. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
Oh, my God.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. America's status as the world's lone superpower is rapidly fading. Other nations and groups of nations are angling to fill the void. Rising in the East is an emerging power block of tremendous potential in manpower, economic heft, and military might. Its growing presence is intensifying global competition for resources and for geopolitical influence. Where will this trend lead? What does this mean for you? Biblical prophecy provides a remarkable, penetrating preview of Asia's future. Request a free copy of Russia and China in Prophecy. This book exposes in startling detail what Russia and China are doing and will do, and how they will affect your life. Also, you'll be sent a free one-year subscription to The Trumpet magazine. The Trumpet looks at today's headlines through the clear light of Bible prophecy. The Trumpet will keep you up to date on the continuing rise of the powers in the East by taking a hard look at today's news and comparing it to the prophecies of the Bible. The Trumpet magazine is this world's most informed news magazine. To learn more, request a free copy of Russia and China in Prophecy. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. Act today and request Russia and China in Prophecy. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
I'm glad that Sam played that promo there for the Russia and China in Prophecy booklet. I meant to reference that right there at the end of the first segment because, really, again, these alliances are beginning to take shape. And it's the leadership in Israel, specifically the United States, that's accelerating the formation of these power alliances spoken of in Bible prophecy. This Asian conglomerate, Russia and China. You look for that connection. There's another conglomerate as far as trade is concerned. We've talked about it often in recent months. The Mart of Nations, Isaiah 23. And then also, of course, the 10 kings in Europe. And the strong man that's going to emerge out of Germany. And even if you look further, if you study that Russia and China in Prophecy booklet, the connection between Germany and Russia. You see that in Bible prophecy. You see it in history. My father writes in the booklet, every time competition between Russia and Germany heats up, they form a deal with each other just before going to war. I mean, that's where all of this is leading. Great tribulation. And here the U.S. president comes into town and says, look, you've got this pipeline deal. You're making all of this money, or Germany's sending billions and billions to Russia. And we want some of that. And oh, by the way, we're supposed to protect you from Russia. What are you doing? I mean, this is upsetting the balance. The American-dominated balance that's been there since the end of World War II. Global stability, it's shaking. And the United States, Great Britain, we don't know what's coming. We have no idea where all of this is leading. We're totally blind to so many of these prophecies I've mentioned recently. Just in going through the New Throne of David book and the jolt there on page 36, there's also a really amazing section about Samaria. I think it's in around about the 70s. And it brings out some verses in the book of Micah, Micah chapter 1 in particular. It says in verse 5, look at this. It says, for the transgression of Jacob is all this, and for the sins of the house of Israel, Why is the transgression? What is the transgression of Jacob, it says? Is it not Samaria? And what are the high places of Judah? Are they not Jerusalem? Samaria, as my father notes in the book, this was the region that Jeroboam selected as the capital of the northern kingdom, or at least after Jeroboam rebelled against the house of David. Samaria eventually became the capital of Israel, the northern 10 tribes. 1 Kings 12, though, talks about Jeroboam rejecting the house of David. And you know the history. We've talked about it so many times before. He went up north. He established his own religion, his own form of righteousness. And that's the same kind of religion that you see today in the United States, in Britain. There's a form of righteousness, but that's about it. My father writes in the book, anciently, Jeroboam hated the throne of David. The modern nations of Israel have rejected it as well. That's why God removed that throne from Britain. We must escape the transgression of Samaria. See that transgression of Samaria? It's the sin of Jeroboam. It's the rebellion against the house of David, the throne of David. And notice, you know, you talk about sobering prophecies. Verse 3, just backing up to Micah 1 and verse 3, it says, "For behold, the Eternal comes forth out of his place and will come down and tread upon the high places of the earth, and the mountains shall be molten under him, and the valleys shall be cleft as wax before the fire, and as the waters that are poured down a steep place." This is describing the punishment that God will soon bring upon our Israelite nations, the end-time descendants of ancient Israel, those northern 10 tribes. Ephraim and Manasseh came from them. That's the United States and Britain. Here is a Bible prophecy talking about fire, or nuclear fire. Talk about a jolt. He says in verse 6, I read verse 5 earlier, he says in verse 6, "Therefore I will make Samaria as an heap of the field and as plantings of a vineyard, and I will pour down the stones thereof into the valley, and I will discover the foundations thereof." God's talking. This is from my father's book, page 75. He says, God is talking about Samaria in this way because of the urgency of the time and how little time remains before the punishment will begin. He wants us to see that it all ends with Jeroboam. Jeroboam and Samaria date this prophecy. He says, this is the chilling reality about time. There is a deadline. This is talking about the administration of the current American president. I mean, there's a deadline on these prophecies. That's what we've got to try to wrap our minds around. You talk about incentive to take action this day. You talk about the incentive to take on more. God expects more, as page 36 says. And then in that same section, right there in the mid-70s of the book, the new book, the New Throne of David, my father talks about just how divided the United States is today. He says, what's wrong with this nation? Look at how dangerously divided we are. Here you have the radical left waging this war on the Trump administration, sowing all kinds of rebellion and discord and chaos. He says on page 77, considering all the inflammatory rhetoric from the left, is it any wonder that more and more people are growing agitated and hateful, feeling like they're fighting for their lives? There are some really mentally disturbed people in America. I mean, who can deny that? There are a lot of mentally unstable people in the United States. I mean, they're panicking because they think this side is evil, and then that side thinks the other side's evil. How much longer can a nation this divided survive? You know, my father in that same section, he takes you back to a Victor Davis Hanson piece as well, one from last year around this time. Can a divided America survive? Can a divided America continue? Well, as my father brings out, he notes how that President Trump has said, my administration's under siege. In fact, our nations are under siege. That's the reality. The survival of the American nation is at stake here. It's under threat. As my father says, America's on the verge of a civil war that will set our cities ablaze. Even before the bombs drop. You see, it's this internal hatred and violence, the fulfillment of Ezekiel 4 and 5, that's going to leave the United States totally unprepared for an attack from without. This is how it unfolds in Bible prophecy. The attack from within, that happens first, and then the attack from without. And as President Trump, as he goes out and about disrupting the status quo, the nations of this world are mobilizing for action. Action this day. The times of the Gentiles. And we're going to be totally and completely unprepared for what's coming upon us. My father writes, this is page 76, the Anglo-American world order created stability for over 200 years, twice in the last century. These nations rose up to stamp out violent, brutal efforts to take over the world. How different history would be if they had failed. Yes, indeed. What would our nations be like today if Winston Churchill never came along? If someone wasn't willing to act in May of 1940, I mean, here we have created this stability, the United States and Great Britain before us, this stability that's lasted for over two centuries, stamping out these violent forces of oppression. I mean, this is why we've got to know our history, as I've been covering recently as well. We need to know the history of the British Empire and the history of the great United States. The United States and Britain in prophecy will pretty much give you all that you need to know. There's some additional reading that we could do outside of that, as you've been hearing. I mean, we'd recommend the Manchester series. But here are these two great peoples, or at least they once were great, creating this stability the world over, 200 years, two centuries. And yet now look at the sickness and the division today. Where are we? We're at the point of verse 9 in this same chapter, Micah 1, verse 9, where it says, for her wound is incurable. Faith in a human leader will not cure this wound. The only help, the only protection, the only cure is in God. And that's why, as my father writes on page 77, that's why he says we must live our daily lives fully aware of the shocking shortness of time. We must be urgent about our prayer, Bible study, and spiritual endeavors. Look at how engaged emotionally and spiritually the prophet Micah was in doing the work God gave him. He references verse 8, by the way. Here you have all of this destruction. God talks about the sins of Samaria and then the fire from heaven. That's verses 3 and 4. Verse 6 as well. Samaria being laid waste like an heap of the field. And then the incurable wound in verse 9. But in verse 8, Micah says, therefore I will wail and howl. I will go stripped and naked. I will make a wailing like the dragons and mourning as the owls. I mean, look at how engaged he was in his mission. Look at how serious he was about his responsibility. Look at the action. Therefore, I will wail and howl. I will go stripped and naked. I will make a wailing like the dragons. He says, I will three times. I will take action. Will you? These same shocking prophecies about nuclear destruction. They're right there in the context of what God says in Micah 1 and verse 15 about the cave of Adullam. And then Micah 2 and verse 13 about the breaker and the king leading God's people to a place of protection, where they're then finally trained, I mean, the place of final training and preparation for their role as kings and priests for God, for their responsibilities to rule and to reign with Jesus Christ. We've got to be living our daily lives fully aware of just how short time is. Action this day. We can't wait. We can't wait. I want to take you back to page 36 again. I know I read it on Monday. I'm going to do a whole program on this later because it's so inspiring, because it is such a jolt, as I said Monday. Page 36 of the New Throne of David. My father says the throne of David is all about saving all of humanity. Do we realize who we are? Do we realize what God is using us to do? God has upped the ante considerably. He expects more of us. He believes we can do more. He believes, with everybody pitching in, that we're going to excel in every way. But we're going to do it on our knees, just like Mr. Armstrong did at that prayer rock. It's the only way. He goes on and says we need to be thanking God and asking him to help us rise to the level he wants, to publicize this message, and to usher in the throne of God to this world. It's going to take action. Action this day. Be more concerned about inaction than action. This is a lesson from the Bible, as we heard last night at PYC orientation. God says, be you doers of the word. Doers, not hearers only. Hearers deceive themselves. God needs doers supporting his work. Nothing happens until something moves. Start moving today. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, as always, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.